This episode is brought to you by HivePass. HivePass is the latest in membership management software that brings a radically different approach to how members join your organization, their experience as a member, and how you interact with them. Built by not only an app developer, but also a mountain biker, HivePass was made by a trail user for trail users. With an app-based platform, instant digital membership cards, ability to send push notifications to members, in-app trail status reports unique to your organization, HivePass is building the next generation of membership management software for your organization. Future additions to HivePass include an event system, automated custom trailhead signs, and much more. HivePass has been live in New Zealand and Australia for a few years, but just launched in Canada, and with this announcement, the United States. Over 50,000 trail users already use HivePass to support their local trail organization. HivePass is the world's first app-based membership management software built specifically for trail organizations. For all of the details, check out hivepass.app. That's www.hivepass.app, or download the HivePass app today. You're listening to Frontlines, a podcast for the people that truly make mountain biking happen. Not the riders, racers, or product designers, but the builders, advocates, and the often forgotten board members of your local mountain bike trail association. My conversation today is focused on youth in the sport of mountain biking, and is very related to the work that I'm focused on right now with my local trail association, the North Shore Mountain Bike Association. When it comes to trail days that I lead, they are mostly youth-orientated. Groups like Take a Hike, a public school outdoor ed program, or various schools around the Lower Mainland, getting youth out doing trail work has its challenges, but nothing compares to that spark moment you see from some students when they realize how much fun trail building is. I'm confident that in the thousands of students I've led on trail days, many of them will become leaders, stewards, and perhaps a few will even become trail builders as they get older. Now, I'm your host, Brent Hillier, and this is episode 90 of Frontlines. I'm joined today by Amanda Carey. She's the president of the National Interscholastic Cycling Association, also known as NICA, and she joins me from Victor, Idaho. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
To begin, let's just start by talking about what the National Interscholastic Cycling Association is and how they got started.
Yeah, great question and good place to start. So NICA, affectionately known as NICA in short, we are the National Interscholastic Cycling Association. We do youth mountain biking programs for student athletes in grades 6 to 12 across the United States. We have 32 leagues right now in 30 states across the United States. We currently do actually have international interest. We're not there yet. So for your international listeners, know that, again, what we do is based in the United States. And we are actively, I think, throughout this conversation, you'll probably hear, really changing what mountain biking can mean in the United States and really turning it into a lifelong sport for, at this point, we're at 25,000 kids and 14,000 coaches across the United States.
That's awesome. And how did you get involved with NICA?
Personally, like a lot of folks in NICA, I started as a volunteer. So I have a long history in nonprofit. I've been a professional mountain biker. And I will say, you'll hear my bias throughout this conversation probably, I just think mountain biking is the best sport known to humankind. So I will definitely show my bias there. But, you know, throughout my whole mountain biking journey, I have been involved in nonprofits every step of the way of my professional career. So I think it was back in somewhere in the 2000s where I was working in trail advocacy, took a break from some cycling and pedestrian advocacy organizations I've been working for, went into a professional mountain biking career. I was an ultra endurance athlete for a little bit, and really I did swear up and down that I was going to get out of nonprofit because I was going to get into coaching. And in somehow I found my way back to nonprofit through trail advocacy, through essentially an invitation to start leading an IMBA chapter. So lots of you know, International Mountain Biking Association has chapters across the United States. And there was one here locally called Mountain Bike the Tetons. that needed some help getting up off the ground. And so I stepped back into trail advocacy again, having thought I was going to take a little bit of a change in direction. I had finished a master's degree in sports psychology, was preparing for a career that, again, outside of nonprofit, was going to go full time into coaching. I started working for IMBA, and through IMBA and through trail advocacy, that's how I got my introduction to NICA. And it's a little bit of a funny story, because the goal of our organization at the time, MBT, was to bring economic development to the valley through mountain biking. And when I became aware of NICA, it was starting up in the Idaho League, based out of Boise. Back in 2015, I heard about this wonderful organization, didn't know much about it, but what I thought was that we would have here in Teton Valley a great place for a NICA race. So I invited the executive director over to have a meeting with the, I think it was the sales manager and the owner of Grand Targhee Resort. And again, whole long story short, we had an hour meeting, and I walked out of that meeting thinking, well, this is an organization I need to get involved with, which was NICA. And I think I might have gone home that day and told my husband that this is a thing that we needed to do. And so we ended up from there starting our first NICA team here locally, because again, there was a lot of alignment, just the purpose of the organization and really what it was trying to do and how it was trying to do it. It was just so in line with what my husband and I really wanted to get out of mountain biking in the future. Because again, I had just stopped racing and he had stepped back from a career as being a mechanic on the road for Giant. And we were really looking for that next best thing. And from there, it kind of took over our lives in all of the best ways. So we were the head coaches and the team directors of the local Teton Valley composite team. And that was an 8-year journey. And early on in that journey, I left the IMBA chapter and started working for the NICA national organization in coach education. And again, that's a really long, twisty story, but I think it really was a little bit of fate in there of just my involvement in trail advocacy in general really pointed me towards an organization that I felt like had even better alignment with what I wanted to do professionally, what I was interested with coaching. And, you know, here I am, about 7-8 years later, the president of the organization. Life's funny that way, but it all worked out for me in the most positive way.
I know I can definitely relate, and I'm sure a lot of listeners can, where, you know, there's a lot of frustration that comes with advocacy work and nonprofit work, and that feeling of kind of being pulled back in or dragged back in is certainly there, but it's that passion and that reward that kind of comes with that work that tends to kind of keep us coming back. And you know, I think if we weren't as passionate about it, it probably wouldn't be as stressful, and it probably wouldn't be as rewarding either. So it's just a part of it. I'd love to kind of hear just maybe even starting from the bottom, how it kind of works for the student athletes, as well as the teams and then the league. So let's say a high school student has an opportunity to join their local race team. Are they doing that through their high school, or are they doing it through their league? How does that work?
Yeah, it looks a little bit different, and that's on purpose and by design all over the country. I will say that our structure it's consistent in a lot of ways, but we also allow for a lot of what we call regional variability, just depending upon what the local resources are, what the local trails are. And that's reflected a lot in how teams actually develop. But I think the mechanics of it are, say it, I'll use Idaho as an example, because I'm here in the Idaho League. The Idaho League has a league director, and that person's job is to run programming and oversee programming in the entire state. And so when we say programming, that's team formation, that's the events, that's the races, that's the adventure programming. You know, some of our leagues have camps, all of our leagues have grit programming, but it is really overseen by a league director at the state level. And in each community, and what we hope, and we've seen this growth over time, is that every community has its own NICA team, right? So we provide all of the structure, all of the training, all of the insurance, all of the everything that we call interested volunteers, because all of our coaches, believe it or not, are mostly volunteers, have at their, you know, at their disposal, so they can run these teams under these leagues. And so you get that high school kid that's interested. Depends. Sometimes it's a school-based team. Often it's a group of high schools or a group of what we call composite teams that come together and they form one team. And from there, it's, you know, it's team practices all run by the head coach and then all of the volunteer coaches that come along with it. And again, it's really overseen and structured at that league level and at that state level. So I think right now, I haven't looked recently, but I think Idaho is close to 30 teams across the state. We're actually pretty rural in nature. So you'll see a difference depending on where they are. So in Boise, where there's a lot of population density and they have a ton of trails and riding, we actually have more school-based teams than in the more rural areas, say like where I am in Teton Valley. We have a composite team, which is a group of middle schools and high schools, homeschool, private, and public schools that have all come together and form one team. So that's really what I mean by that regional variability. Our whole goal is to give that flexibility when needed, structure also when needed, to set up, again, all of these amazing local volunteers to set up and run teams in the way that suits their community best.
That's great. I mean, every community is certainly unique, and something I definitely want to talk more about is just trails in general and where these students are riding. But, you know, urban trails versus rural trails, and so it's great to hear that NICA is flexible with that kind of stuff. I think sometimes when we talk about national organizations, it usually comes with a lot of structure, and that can always be challenging, I think, for some smaller communities. So that's great to hear that there's a lot of flexibility here. Who makes up these volunteers, these coaches? Is it parents? Is it teachers? Where do you kind of see those volunteers coming from?
Well, I will first call them heroes. And I mean that with no joking aside, yeah. Because they really do come from every background. And when I do talk about NICA, and I'm a coach myself, I've been, a head coach and a team director and a level 3 coach. I mean, it takes, it is the volunteer that makes our organization run. We would be absolutely nowhere without our volunteer coaches. So again, big shout out to anyone who coaches or even thinks about coaching, because it's actually pretty wide. I will say statistically, over 75% of our coaches are parents. And that absolutely should tell, you know, everyone who's interested in NICA something about how the program is structured, where it's extremely, not only family friendly, it's family dependent, right? Where this is a sport and it's an opportunity where parents can participate alongside with their kids. And it's a really, I don't want to say it's unique, but it's definitely one of those sports in the United States where we have created an intentional invitation for the parents to join alongside with us, because we literally need their help, right? We have a very high need for coaches. Actually, our ratio right now is about 2-1. For every 2 student athletes, we have 1 coach because of the structure of the organization. On trail rides, we need 1 coach for every 6 student athletes or 2 coaches for every 8, right? That's, you know, safety and risk management and responsible use on the trails. But what I think sets us apart is that we are very particular with how we message to coaches and saying, hey, you don't have to be an amazing mountain biker. Actually, you probably can be a beginner and you will do just fine, because the way we invite coaches in is the same way we invite our student athletes in, right? It's any skill level and ability is welcome here. You know, we don't have anything as like a bench or a tryout. If you want to be on the team, you're on the team. That goes for coaches as well. We have a really robust coaching education program that matches essentially their level of interest to the level of training that they'll get, right? So you have the super duper involved, highly trained head coaches and level 3 coaches. And then all the way down to the level 1, you know, general volunteer, they have a level of education as well. But we try and set up that structure that's attainable and that it's not too overwhelming and that it really matches their interest level in when they coach and how they coach.
Do you find with relying heavily on parents that there's kind of a natural turnover with that coaching staff? Like I know as a parent, you're going to be there when your kid's kind of in the program. And is there a natural kind of shift of responsibility to other parents that are coming in with their younger students, or how does that work?
Yeah. And I actually think that's a good thing, right? I think, you know, nationally, when you look at the average of any youth coach in the United States, and this is not particular to mountain biking, you're usually looking at a 3-4 year commitment, right? And I think that does correlate with the age of the kids and the interest level of the kids. And I think that's a good thing, right? The the outlier, folks like me, right? Don't have my own kids. We actually end up staying longer. We were in it for 8 or 9 years. And so again, what we don't try to do is push against the known expectations of that general volunteer. We really just try and support and welcome in as many new coaches as possible, while also knowing that it is a big ask. It is a lot of time. And that, you know, when folks are ready to either enter or to be done, that we respect that for sure. So it's natural attrition, which is why we try just as hard to recruit new student athletes as we do coaches. Because again, coaches are such an important part of the ecosystem. And I think a part of what that secret to NICA is that a lot of folks don't know about is that our general volunteers, right, is the, you know, the level one coach that just maybe is like, okay, well, my kid doing this and I'll probably do it too. And it turns into the best thing that they have done with their personal time in a long time. Because I think what most folks find is they get out of it just as much, if not more, than what their kids are getting out of it. I certainly experienced this where I felt like, you know, when we first started, and I say we, my husband and I, we started learning about NICA and getting the team going. And we had this vision that, we were doing something great for the kids and the community and just mountain biking in general. And this was something we wanted to be a part of. Every step of the way, we just kind of kept having these aha moments of, boy, I'm learning a lot, or boy, I'm growing, or boy, these kids are, you know, teaching me things that I never knew I needed to learn. Right. And I think that, that growth is something that, you know, as coaches and as leaders, we try to instill in our student athletes. But boy, I'll tell you, almost every single coach that coaches in NICA comes back and says, or even early on in the process, I'm getting more out of this than my kids are. I mean, this is a part of the journey that I did not expect. And there's the simple stuff, like when, you know, you got practices 3 times a week, you have to go ride your bike 3 times a week. And that's actually a really good thing for adults too. But I do think generally speaking, you know, coaching really is a gift of service. And oftentimes we go in and we think that we're serving others, and that's genuinely the, you know, a very good thing to do. But also at the same time, we get service to ourselves, and that's just the best of both worlds.
The kids that are coming into this program, I think very naturally, the kids that are coming from mountain bike families are probably going to get pulled into this program very early on. It just seems like if, you know, you grew up mountain biking and your school's offering a mountain bike team, that's such a great thing to participate in. But are you getting kids that maybe aren't coming from those quote unquote mountain bike families as well joining the programs?
Not enough. That is our next level of growth that we, I think, collectively, and it's not just NICA, I think mountain biking in general needs to be more welcoming and more inclusive to new riders and to new families. But I think that that's where we have the best and most important opportunity for growth. And so I will say that I'm definitely biased, but I absolutely think that mountain biking, and especially that the way NICA does it, should be an example for all youth sport. And I mean it when I say, you know, the way we do sports is different, and it's arguably better in the sense where we don't have truck cuts. We don't have tryouts. We don't have an expectation of a skill or a commitment level for a student athlete to be able to participate. And if you look at sports in the United States, I know it's different elsewhere, but in the United States, I think we've increasingly set up a system where a kid has to be increasingly better at a sport to get the right to participate, right? When you think about freshman year, sophomore year, then you're talking, you know, freshman team, and then the tryouts for the basketball team. And then if you don't make the cut, then what? And it's hard. It's a reality of the way sports are set up. But I think what NICA has done and figured out is that we take the hardest hitting, and some of these varsity athletes are so fast. They work so hard and they are at the pointy end of the race. And then we have, you know, your general sixth grader, seventh grader that's just getting an introduction to the sport, maybe doesn't want to race because, again, racing is not required to be a part of a NICA team. But what I think we've figured out better than any other sport is to keep those kids, those two very different kids, included on the same team. Because what we've been able to do is figure out, hey, we are looking at an individual, not an entire team. A lot of it is the benefit of the way mountain biking is, right? It's an individual sport. But we have figured out really how to find that fine balance of the super competitive kids, the ones that don't want to compete at all, and then the ones who are kind of in between, but keep them on the same team and also just keep them motivated for what I think the purpose of youth sport should be, right? The purpose of youth sport, and again, I could go down this rabbit hole for a long time into what we've done to youth sport in the United States, but I think when we take a step back, we look at really what is the purpose of sport, and especially for kids, it's to be active, it's to be healthy, it's to build skill, it's to build, you know, whether it's team building or learning how to compete or so many life skills and abilities that because we've created a system where we base it on ability, we're excluding so many kids. And again, at the end of the day, I really do think that that's the structure of NICA and how we do programming is that's, I mean, that really is the story of NICA, and it does go beyond mountain biking. So I know it's a little bit of a tangent back to the original question, but that is the main motivator for us to think big and to really think about why is it so important that we get more kids on bikes. And I think it is about getting kids outside and happy and active and healthy and feeling included and being on a team and being off their screens. But I do think for those new families, especially that aren't yet mountain bikers, because again, I think to your question, we've already done a really good job of getting that word out to families that already mountain bike, right? So you say you have an uncle or you have a neighbor. We have most of those adjacent, of mountain biking adjacent families already either aware or participating. And I think that next level for us and where we should all be focused on as advocates, as youth sports people, is really just looking at the benefits of how NICA has a really structured youth sport just to give kids all of those opportunities. And so for that next generation, that next phase of growth, it's for all those reasons that we really want to be more inviting and more supportive of new mountain bikers and new families.
That's great. You know, the thing that comes to mind is playing football in high school. It took until the last game of the season in my last year of school to realize that, oh, this will be the last time that I play football.
Right.
And it was one of those things that I never really thought about. And football did not define me at all. I was part of a team that actually didn't make any cuts. We had to take two buses to get to games, and it was just a really fun environment. I never even played in a single game. I joked that I was the ending guard, as in I was at the end of the bench and I was guarding the water bucket. But I loved the environment. I loved being there, and to be included in that group of players was really fun, but it that was not going to be a way that I was going to stay fit as an adult. And what's great about mountain biking is that it is a lifestyle, and sure, there's a competitive aspect to it, and you can do racing you can do all this stuff, but it's also just a way for you to get out after work and get some exercise. So I love kind of including this in youth sport and making this an option, because I think it's going to do a much better job of creating kids that have healthy lifestyles as they go into adulthood, which is wonderful.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, you know, just as a quick follow-up, our goal really is, and NICA, it's cyclists for life. It's not racers for high school. because again, it is, like you said, with the football team, and no knock on other sports, because again, I think any sport or any activity that gets a kid engaged and feeling like they have the ability to be included and that they're part of something bigger is so important, no matter what that sport is. But there's something different about cycling and mountain biking that they will take that skill to anywhere they want to later in life. And that really is our goal. We are not a development or an elite organization by any means. We're focused on character development. We're a youth development organization. And we take a lot of pride in the fact that when we survey our seniors, when they leave the program, they say about 97% of them say they're going to continue to ride. And for us, that is absolutely the best metric we can go on, because what we're really trying to do is instill in them a love for the sport and a love for, again, the outdoors, physical activity, and just being outside and doing something that helps their, you know, physical and emotional health. And that, again, if they can take what they learned as middle schoolers and high schools, you know, onto the next level of their life, I mean, gosh, goal achieved. And I also think too, what's unique about NICA is that we have figured out Because again, like when you talked about your experience on the football team, that is what motivates kids. That's what drives kids, is they want to be with their friends, right? They want to be doing something that's fun and mostly just doing what their friends are doing. And I think what Nika figured out early on, whether it was on purpose or not, is that we figured out how to make a individual sport into a team sport, right? Which is again, really what middle schoolers and high schoolers need, to drive sport participation. There's a lot of other factors too, but really at that age, they are looking for belonging and they are looking for community and they're looking for what, quite frankly, their friends are doing. And there were plenty, I mean, back in the day when Nika started up, there were plenty of adult mountain bike races that kids could go to. But that wasn't it, right? It wasn't just showing up in an adult race. Nika has turned an individual sport into a youth-specific environment, and it really just is the best of both worlds.
One thing that we hear as trail advocates, even whether it's talking to land managers or municipal councils or politicians, is the sport of mountain biking has this kind of appearance that it's not accessible, that there's a natural barrier with mountain biking, and that is the bicycle. How does Nika kind of work to address the fact that, and maybe it's just a perception, but that the bicycle is a barrier for students to actually participate?
Yeah, that's a great point. When I think about barriers, I think of, you know, I kind of zoom out and look at them from, I'm trying to be articulate about this because it's not just one simple thing. So it's not just the bike or just the trails. It really is that whole holistic system that's going to set someone, anyone, whether it's a kid or an adult, up for that access. So first, I'll absolutely agree, because I've been in this advocacy game for a long time too, like a lot of your listeners, is it's hard, right? It is hard, because what we are responsible for is not just the trails, not just the bikes, not just the program. And it feels like it's a lot of it. So, when I zoom out and I really look at what is the entire system that someone needs to become a mountain biker, believe it or not, sometimes I think that, at least from the youth aspect, the bike is the easy part. I'm not saying it's easy. But oftentimes when we think about that perfect trifecta of what sets someone up for success, right? It's programs, it's equipment, and it's places, right? So it's the programs. Do you have a reputable program like a Nika or a Little Bella's where a parent is going to feel comfortable, especially as a new rider or a new family, you know, kind of handing their kid over and trusting their kid into? Do we have the bikes and the equipment? Because again, you need the bike and the helmet and the shoes, at least at the minimum, to get started. And then trails, and it's not just trails. I think a lot of us in advocacy know that if you have sweet trails an hour away, you still have sweet trails an hour away, right? So that's absolutely going to impact your ability and your frequency to get out there. And you're looking at transportation. Does someone have leisure time, right? Does mom or dad not have a job? Or do they have leisure time to pick a kid up and drive them to the trailhead? That's, you know, how many miles away? So there are so many confounding factors that go into what creates access or limits access. And it's almost never one thing. So the bikes, believe it or not, when I think about the barriers to new families or to new riders or folks that don't get to ride a lot, I actually think the bike is the easiest part, believe it or not. You then get into, and I say it's easy because at least up until now, money is easy to raise, bikes are easy to purchase. But it's then, where do you store that bike, right? If someone doesn't own a bike rack, how do you get that bike back and forth to the trailhead? Same thing with the trailhead. If that trailhead's an hour away, how are you going to get there, right? So I think we have programs in place. You know, we have scholarships, we have the Nika Pathfinders program. We have definitely created a system of support that can help an individual once they come to us get access. But it's not easy. Looking at the whole system of barriers, I think it is sometimes feeling like a big boulder to push uphill. And we can't do it all. And I also think that when you do talk to land managers or you do talk to anyone about trying to get trails built in a community, the more you can look at that whole holistic system of what are going to be the barriers for participation or for, you know, getting those new trails built, that's the programming piece of it and the youth that can be really, really helpful to getting those initiatives or getting those things approved.
Yeah, that's something else that comes to mind with these programs. I live in a community that is rich with trails, and when I moved here, I was so amazed by this wonderful high school race league that had been around for much longer than it had been around for a while, and it's very successful, but all of these schools back onto a wonderful trail network. And then there's a league that has kind of flourished as well. And so you get kids from the Sunshine Coast and Squamish and Whistler, and they will race at various races, even on the weekends. And it's this wonderful program. But when I look to communities in the lower mainland of BC, where I live, that are trail poor, those schools don't have those kind of race teams. And so how do we kind of address this? Is there anything that NICA is trying to do to make sure that they're reaching kids and neighborhoods that are considered kind of trail poor, or don't have those close trails to their schools or to their neighborhoods?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great point. We see the same thing in the States. I'll tell you, our largest league right now is Utah. And it last year had 7,400 kids in it. And I think what Utah has is population density close to trails. There's definitely affluence. There's definitely all these other factors as well. But that really is the key to Utah's, I wouldn't say success, but their size and scale. It's just a huge population with gosh, the trail access there is you can probably leave a school or you can leave a neighborhood and pedal your bike in most places 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and you're at a trailhead. We see the same thing, Boise, Idaho, huge population. Again, Idaho's not that big, but what we have for population density, again, all of those kids are pedaling to trails. So we see the same thing, absolutely. And what we also know is that in trail development efforts, we're working closely with IMBA on this right now, because again, NICA, I think our opportunity in advocacy is to advocate for our needs. We're not a trail building organization, but we are absolutely needing to step more into the space to be advocates on our own behalf for, you know, the trail systems and the infrastructure that we do need. But I think big picture, looking at trail opportunities, again, for new trails, it's just that old, you know, trails close to home. I think that's close to IMBA's initiative right now, which is trails close to home. We just say trails close to kids. Because again, we, at least in the United States, I think early on in IMBA's days and all of our days, and I think anyone who's been in the advocacy game for a long time, we know that advocacy has grown and changed and evolved over time. And early on, those of us who were in it early on, we're mostly advanced riders, right? I think I'm telling a story everyone already knows, but we went out and we built, you know, Black Diamond trails for ourselves, right? Because that was the stuff that we wanted to ride. And I think in the change in advocacy now, as we have this high proliferation of really well-skilled professional trail building companies, advocacy has changed in the sense where we're working on more community-based trail systems rather than, you know, individual trails for individual users. I think that really is the next level for us, is thinking about, well, what is going to drive the most participation? Is it the fun remote stuff that the advanced riders want to ride? Or is it accessible trails that when you hang up from a conference call at 5 o'clock, you can, you know, gosh, just get out of the house for a quick hour, pedal up the street, you know, pedal 10 minutes and get to that local community trail system. And I really think that is the new phase of advocacy, at least for NICA, is telling that story of trails close to home, trails closer to kids, community trail systems that are built for everybody, right? Not just one user, is really not only the future that's going to get people outside and get happier and healthier and pedaling, whether it's after work or just, you know, that quick break. I think that's really where we need to invest our time. And so we are actively trying to step into that advocacy space. But we also rely very heavily on, you know, trail advocates like your listeners and everyone else, to think about, you know, the beginner rider, NICA riders, families, and really when you're thinking about building new trail systems or asking for new trail systems, incorporating, you know, the greens and the blues, and most importantly, those community trails. Because again, if it's close to home, you've removed one barrier right there.
as a trail builder, I think, you know, getting kids on bikes is easy to identify as a really good thing, but it's, as a trail builder, it's always one of those things where we're thinking about impact. And so whether it's kids or not, a large quantity of riders is going to have an impact on the trail. And so, you know, there's a number of associations that might have a concern with, you know, either hosting a race or hosting kind of regular big group rides, with a bunch of kids. How can a high school mountain bike program benefit a trail association, you know, as opposed to just simply being another user added to those trails?
Oh gosh, so many angles to take this from, but I just think more is better. I really do. I mean, I think the more people we get involved, and again, I'll show my bias. I really just think mountain biking is the best sport on the planet for everything, right? For mental health, for physical health, for being outside. I really think that this idea of pulling the ladder up behind us is just, it's just not my philosophy ever. I don't know. I hope it's not everyone's, but this idea that by creating more trails, we're creating more users, I think that should be the goal. And the goal should be more focused on management of those users and of those use, right? Not trying to limit use. And again, I've been in many conversations with land managers when we talk about this. And, you know, whether you're talking about e-bikes or you're talking about horse bike conflict, we typically do not solve those problems at all, with trail design. I mean, we have, you know, you can have directional trails and things like that, but at the end of the day, it's always about user education and user conflicts. How can we get out there and manage ourselves and manage our conflicts and be better users when we have those trail interactions? I've been an advocate for that for ever since I started in trail advocacy, because, it's, you know, it's not the e-bike, it's the rider of the e-bike, right? It's not the horseback rider or the horse itself, it's the horseback rider. And it's really behavior versus the creation of new trails. So I think philosophically, if we look at how can we all get along better as our goal, that's a good place to start. And so I think with NICA, if I was talking to a local trail advocate of why get all these young kids, because again, they're young kids, right? They are in their learning phase. They are, we know full brain development doesn't really happen until age, you know, 24. So they still have a lot to learn, a lot to grow, you know, with their own development. But I do think that, you know, at least from NICA's perspective, we feel a really deep responsibility for character development and for being responsible users, right? I think going back to the whole, and again, a lot of us who've been in advocacy for a long time know that old ethic of, you know, the you ride, you dig. And from there, there is a responsibility for taking care of the trails and giving back to trail systems, because again, having trails is a privilege, not a right. And so early on, maybe a couple of years after NICA formed, we started the Teen Trail Corps program. And Teen Trail Corps is our program for advocacy, to instill advocacy values, stewardship values into everything that we do at NICA. And it goes far beyond, you know, don't throw garbage on the trail, leave no trace. Really what we're trying to do is teach student athletes through the Teen Trail Corps program about not only advocacy, but their responsibility to be advocates. And much like I said, our goal was cyclists for life. We really do believe that we are training the next generation of advocates, because starting with, you know, interactions on trails, you will, and I think I've told this story to many folks before, but I always know when I see a NICA rider on the trail, always know it. And when I see a NICA coach, because they are most often very respectful. They've pulled over, they smile, they wave, they say thank you. That is a big part of our user education, because again, being in groups out on the trail, and especially with teenagers, our coaches are extremely conscientious about the use and how we interact with other users on the trail. And then with Teen Trail Corps, especially, most of our teams are now doing service hours. So they have the ability to track their hours with, most of them are partnering with their local trail associations. And so back to the, I think, original question, which is, you know, why are kids benefiting, or how can kids benefit local trail associations? They are actively doing trail maintenance in their communities. So if you have a local NICA team, please reach out, because they are really hungry for these opportunities to give back to the trails. But it is the Teen Trail Corps program is a structured part of the NICA programming and curriculum, because again, we know that we are having a big impact on trails, right? And to any land manager who would ask, like, yeah, absolutely. If I have 75 kids on a mountain bike team, I am going to do my very best to, you know, spread them out, put them in small groups, send them in different directions. But at the end of the day, absolutely, there is an impact. But we also are, we try to be very clear about how we educate kids and coaches and have an expectation of responsible use so that those interactions out there are not only positive, that they're somewhat motivating. And I hear this from people all the time when they have interactions out on the trails. It's almost always a really, really positive ones with Nika teams. So I would say that it's always looking at it from the youth perspective is how are we taking responsibility for educating the next youth? They're the next generation of users. That's something that Nika takes very seriously. And we should see it as an opportunity. Inclusion at a younger age when they're impressionable and they, I mean, they literally don't know any other way until they go out into adult years and maybe see see different behavior. But again, from the advocacy perspective and the stewardship perspective, it is baked into everything that we do at Nika because, again, we know and we teach our student athletes that trails, again, they're a privilege, they're not a right, and that we also rely heavily on others to create those systems for us. I often give the analogy to, you know, to kids or coaches that are trying to understand what these barriers to trail creation are. And I give them the example of the local baseball field or basketball court, right? When most communities have a baseball field where, again, if you're the baseball team, it's where someone built it for you. Someone takes care of it for you. Someone has reserved it for you. So you just show up with the, you know, the mitts and the balls and the bats. You play your game. No one else is going to come onto the field with you at the same time, right? There's not going to be another team that shows up and tries to, you know, run the bases in an opposite direction. And that's just not the reality for mountain biking, right? And I think these kiddos all learn and coaches too early on that the being respectful users, those positive interactions are what is going to dictate how much access we get in the future. And I think we take that really seriously.
Big part of what I do with my local trail association is lead youth trail days. So it's definitely my specialty with the trail association but it comes from a career as an outdoor educator and working with youth, whether it be on winter camping or backpacking or skiing or snowshoeing, that kind of stuff. And so I have, an experience base that I kind of rely on when it comes to maintaining control over, 30 something kids, out in the forest, out in the outdoors. Something that I heard from a couple of advocates recently was that they struggle to kind of engage with a large program like a Nika, for example, in a positive way because the groups are very large and they're just not used to kind of managing a group of volunteers that large. So if a trail organization wants to get their Nika team out, the student athletes out to do trail work, is there options that they can bring them out in smaller groups? Can they, I think maybe the hesitation is that when they put out the invite to the team, they're going to get the whole team and that might just be too much for some organizations to deal with.
Oh, I'm only laughing because I've pictured many times where, you set them up, we flag a corner, right? And you set it up and you walk away for an hour and you come back, yeah. You're like, oh, that was not the plan. Yeah. Yeah. So absolutely get it. Totally understood. Well, I think at least the strength for the Nika culture, and first of all, it is always an option. You can always say, hey, we can only take 10. This is a specific project. And it could be appropriate for maybe the younger kids or the older kids or whatever that is. That is absolutely always an option that's on the table. But I think what Nika has available, at least baked into its structure that can be helpful for advocacy organizations, is that you have trained coaches, right? And so you have, you can set off, and I'm just thinking of my own local team here. I've got at least 3 or 4 coaches that love to just dig on their own. They're really well-versed in this. Not going to be true for every team, but what you have there are the adults, right? So the adults that if you have a specific ask or specific maintenance need that you can pull those adults aside and say, hey, this is really the goal for the day. Be very specific. Don't dig past this. Don't touch this flagging or whatever it is. You can be really prescriptive with that. And just know that you have adults to manage it rather than you're handing 40 kids tools and walking away kind of thing. And again, I'm only joking about it because I've been parts of massive trail days before where you see work get a little, you know, everyone gets a little over their skis and a little too exciting. But it absolutely is manageable. And I think that, again, with the structure of teams and how we require those ratios for adult coaches to student athletes, you do have the ability to have those super leaders there to be more prescriptive with the exact work that you want to have done. And then also understand that they're kids. At the same time, they run out of energy pretty quick, right? Depends on, you know, how or what the nature of the project is. But I think if you think about, you know, what kind of projects you want to bring them into, you know, keep it, I don't want to say low knowledge, but I think it probably is low skill. And then also with NYCA, how we, I'll be clear that we do not allow student athletes to do trail construction. We have only trail maintenance, a little bit of his insurance, but we actually put that barrier, that kind of backstop on the level of construction that they are allowed to do. So it's brushing, it's water bars, it's, you know, it's clipping back vegetation. It's a lot of, you know, bike park cleanups or trash cleanup days, things like that. I think a lot of your advocates can think about just different types of advocacy projects. And that could also be have them do a letter writing campaign, have them show up at a town council meeting. Not all of it needs to be digging. And especially with our older student athletes that are looking for leadership opportunities, engaging them in what, you know, we all know is to be that modern advocacy. The professional trail builders, quite frankly, do such a nice job that there is not really a deep need for maintenance. So I'd encourage everybody to think about those other service opportunities to get kids involved in as well.
Yeah, that's great. I think, you know, sometimes as trail builders, we're so focused on ticking off these big projects. And for me, when I look at leading a trail day, it's the maintenance is just kind of one part of the trail day. There's an opportunity to talk about the local environment and what we are as stewards, also the relationship with land managers. It's this kind of opportunity is to provide some interpretation. And I know that this is again where I kind of bring in my like outdoor educator guiding hat on, where I'm like, I'm bringing kids out into the woods, you know, let's fill this whole program with a bunch of different things as opposed to just, you know, here's a tool and start digging kind of thing. But I think that's great. I think just, you know, if there are organizations out there that are nervous about kind of reaching out, it just thinking outside the box a little bit and maybe just seeing if there's projects that you can engage a larger quantity of students that might work quite well, which is wonderful. So you touched on something there that I definitely want to talk about. And mountain biking has, I would argue, more of a perceived risk. There's certainly risk that revolves around mountain biking. But we're hearing right now a conversation in kind of the outdoor education world about risky play. And I think it's amazing that they're choosing to keep that term risk in that description. Cause for me, I've hit a lot of barriers as an outdoor educator where there's activities that I used to do with students, you know, 10 years ago that I just can't do anymore because of insurance requirements and that type of thing. But we're seeing this huge benefit of having kids be involved with risky play. And it starts from a very young age of like jungle gyms that have consequences to them. And that role in understanding risk, reward, that type of thing. And I think mountain biking is great for that. But how do you deal with concerns from maybe the community or parents or even just, you know, getting insurance for these types of things? Where does the risk aspect come into play with NYCA and how do you kind of tackle that?
Oh gosh, so many, again, different angles to take. But I will also say that I, like you, think kids need more of this, you know, quote unquote risky play than they are getting right now. I think it's apparent and it's showing up in so many different ways that kids in general are not being put into situations where they have the ability to fail, right? Fail in a safe way. And failure can come in a lot of ways, but I think you, being an educator yourself, and I've been in this coaching game for a long time, whether it's risky play or free play or unstructured play, it's going to be hard to tell what that long-term impact is going to be on our kids over time, but we're already starting to see it. And so I think with mountain biking in general, again, show my bias, think it's the best sport ever. I do think that we are uniquely, it's a sport that is uniquely prepared to give kids the opportunity to fail again and again and again in the most just amazing ways, right? You miss a rock, you miss a feature, you miss a whatever, you have the ability to just give it one more pedal stroke, and every new pedal stroke is a new pedal stroke, right? I think mountain biking, again, is one of those sports that it can teach kids that they can do hard things, right? That just that self-efficacy, that ability to believe that you have the ability to do something hard is just baked into everything that we do in mountain biking. So I think on its merits, it's just the best sport to help kids, you know, build that self-confidence. And again, that ability to learn that they can learn new things and they can, you know, be out in the dirt and be out in, you know, the rocks and the wind and the rain, and that they were tougher than they think that they were. And that, whether you're 5 years old or whether you're 40 years old, can show up in your life, in so many different possible ways. And so there's just, you know, that the big statement on that is I think kids definitely need more of that. There's this, I call it the snowplow, or it's not my term, but lots of people are calling it the snowplow parenting now, right? Where you remove every and all obstacle for your child. It's different than the helicopter parent, right? And I just think that in mountain biking, there's always going to be obstacles, which I think is just absolutely the best thing for the kids. But I also think too that the risk, you know, at least at NICA, I would never tell, especially a new parent or anyone that's new to mountain biking, that it's a safe sport. No sport is safe. No activity is safe, right? We drive cars every day, and that's one of the riskiest things that we do. But what I try to do, and what we as an organization try to do, is educate folks on, well, here's all the things that we do to manage risk, right? And it's the same thing with the insurance company. It's the same thing with anyone who's asking about our programs. You know, what are the things that we have in place to make sure that it is an appropriate and manageable amount of risk, right? So we train, you know, all of our coaches get trained on concussion, and risk management, on, you know, they get on the bike skills. There's a requirement for first aid and CPR. We have a very robust athlete abuse prevention program. I mean, the list goes on and on about the education of our coaches and setting up the environment that's going to reduce the amount of risk. But at the end of the day, we always say it's never safe because nothing's ever safe, right? And there's inherent risk, and then there is elevated risk, and you know, you can get on those technical details. But again, we try and educate folks more on this is what we do, and this is how we control the most risk possible. And at the end, and then, you know, the rest of it is, I don't want to say up in the air, but it really is, you know, up to the student athlete and up to the coach. And that's really where NICA's philosophy of progression just plays into everything that we do, because risk, you know, if you look at risk profile, someone who thinks, say, mountain biking is Red Bull Rampage, I think we've at least progressed beyond that, right? To educate everybody that is, you know, it's cross country mountain bike racing for, you know, general blue and green trails, and that the level is not so high. We've done a good job, I think, of educating folks about that. But I think for risk, I think what we try to do is always look at the individual student athlete, and then the individual trail, and then the coaches are all really well versed on what we call assessment, right? If you have a student athlete who's a very, very beginner, and you take them to a black trail, well, that's super risky, right? Because they don't yet have the skills that are going to match the terrain that you're putting in front of them. And so from every step of the way, from progression, what we're always trying to teach our coaches is you have to match the skill that you're seeing in the student athlete with what you're putting in front of them, because risk can come in a lot of different ways, right? Physical risk. If you blow a feature and you tip over and you break a wrist, absolutely, that's not good. And that's, you know, a physical, injury. But then there's also, injury to confidence, right? There's injury to future competence, right? And if you have a coach that puts, and I see this not in NICA, but I've seen this in other coaching elsewhere, where if you put, you know, a kid or any rider in a situation where their skills or even a little bit of stretch of their skills does not match what you are putting them on or the feature, you're absolutely going to blow their confidence. And it's a risk to their ability to feel like they're going to have that self-efficacy in the future to learn that skill and to nail that feature too. So, that I think for risk assessment is, it's just baked into our coaching culture, which is what I try to be really particular to folks who are trying to dig in. I'm like, well, what is this Nika sport all about? What is mountain biking? And I don't talk about really the what we are riding on, but I try to more explain of the how we do it and what our coaching philosophy is, and really what the progression is with matching riders' abilities and their skills to the features that we are all out there trying to ride.
In preparing for this conversation, there was a kind of a funny term that popped up a couple times, and it was Nika venues. And so I'm assuming that kind of is referring to when there is a race, there needs to be a venue that can kind of handle a bunch of kids, a bunch of parents, that's obviously got the trails, but also just has the trailhead infrastructure. And these Nika venues, to use that term, just a venue that can handle kind of a Nika event, they're not always close to where the students are. Like, they can often be, you know, up to a 4-hour drive to get out there. What makes a good venue for a Nika race, and are there enough of them in the country, and are there areas where there needs to be more of them, and areas where maybe they are well served with enough large venues for these types of events?
Yeah, I'm laughing too as you say it, because it's such a unique Nika cultural term, the venues, right? It's venues versus practice venues. And yeah, happy to go into it, because it's a very real thing for us. When you think about it, our impact right now is we have almost 26,000 student athletes in the program, 14,000 volunteer coaches. And then, you know, for just volunteers alone, so the families and parents are so important, it usually takes about 70 to 100 volunteers in addition to put on a race. And so for when we're very particular when we say venues, because we are talking about, it's almost like a festival. If you go to some of these large Nika races where sometimes it's 3,000-4,000 people, depending on the size of the league. So oftentimes we get asked, hey, we've got these great trails and these would be perfect for Nika. And, you know, we come, we look at them, and there's no parking, right? So what's very unique to Nika is that with these venues, we really call our races now event weekends, because sometimes they're two, often 3 days of continuous activities, right? So what we really need for a Nika race event is probably somewhere between 4 to 7 miles of trail, depending on what the course is going to be, and a massive parking lot. I mean, really, that is what makes a Nika venue successful, because the oftentimes the trail systems are great, but if we don't have the parking infrastructure for all these families to come and to drive, and then camping on top of it, we love to allow families to camp for the weekend for these races, then we can have great trails. But if we don't have that parking lot, that really is what we need. And oftentimes in early Nika days, a lot of our league directors would spend a ton of time on Google Maps, literally just looking at aerial photos of trails, and then how big the parking lots could possibly be next to these races. So these venues definitely have unique needs. And to your question, do we have enough of them? We need more of them. I mean, we need more, we need more trails in general. So practice venues, absolutely. You know, practice venues are just, you know, trails that are appropriate for Nika teams. But with these venues, you hit on something that's become even more important to us in the future, is that we absolutely recognize and understand that drive times to get to these events is definitely a barrier, right? Because it's, I mean, we have races here in Idaho where it's an 8-hour drive in just one direction to get to a race. And that really is a lot to ask of a family, especially if, say, you have a middle schooler that's only participating in a 20-minute race, right? So we really absolutely do need, it's more trails closer to home, but race venues and event venues closer to communities as well, because we do see that geographic range is the farther you go out from that 1 hour to 2 hour to 3 hour, those barriers stack up. It's transportation, it's time, it's hotels, it's cost in time, and then it's cost in money as well too. The more of these venues that we can build, the more we can encourage folks to participate in races.
So one thing that we see with youth sport is that often there's great engagement from both boys and girls at younger ages. But as we kind of progress from elementary into middle school and then into high school, we tend to see kind of a drop off of engagement from girls with kind of the athletics, with the sports, with the teams. What's kind of the split right now with NICA? Like, is there a general kind of even divide between boys and girls? Does that kind of drop off as they get older? What is that gender split?
Yeah, for attrition rates in high school, I think you've hit on something for sure. I think girls, you know, by the time they hit age 14, they quit sports at a 70% rate higher than boys. I think there's a lot of confounding factors there, but I think especially when you get to high school, it's getting better, but it's certainly girls are impacted more. And girls are impacted in a lot of ways that boys aren't, just because of the way, you know, it's different wiring. But I also think what we're doing in high school in general, which is what I spoke to earlier, but just the pressure environment. And some of these high school kids, the pressure is just unreal, right? And whether it's self-inflicted or it's coming from family or community, the amount of things that are pulling on their time, which makes it really, really hard to commit to a sport. The higher, you know, that level of commitment is, the more pressure they feel. And I've seen it. I've coached girls for years. I think girls are, at least what I've seen anecdotally, is they're more in tune with that pressure. And they definitely quit sports at a higher rate because of all of the things that are happening to them in high school, you know, social and with school and trying to get into college and those kinds of things too. But, you know, big picture with NICA, we are not even remotely close to where we want to be with equity in our organization, but we are making improvements for sure. So right now, NICA's makeup is about 24% girls and, you know, the rest boys. And we've changed our focus, I think, with looking at where do we want to end up as an organization. Absolutely, we want 50% girls or more in the future, right? Because if you look at the population, we know that it should be at least 50-50 if we're doing our jobs. But we also know that because of the nature of mountain biking, the nature of cycling, the nature of when girls are finding their sport, and that really is imprinted on them at a young age and the rest of their lives, we need to reach out to girls in a different way and include them and recruit them in a different way than we do with boys. So NICA started the GRIT initiative, which is our Girls Riding Together initiative, back in 2018, when our percentage was down at, gosh, it was maybe 17% across the board, 17-18%. So since we started that initiative, we have grown almost 5% at this time. And when I say we're 24% girls, that fluctuates a little bit between our spring and fall leagues. But it's about 23-24%. And then same thing with our coaches. We have increased female coach participation with the GRIT initiative in the same way. And through this initiative, I mean, gosh, it really isn't rocket science, but it really is a set of outreach. How do I explain this best? What we're trying to do is to recruit and retain girls in a way that aligns with how they like to play sports. And for girls, a lot of the times, it really is social. As you spoke to, they do have more confidence at younger ages, because we know by the time girls start to hit puberty, it's when that confidence gap really starts to open up, right? And so we know if we can get to them and get them introduced to mountain biking at a younger age and this is where Little Bellas is doing such a nice job, where they can build the skills and the competence and the confidence before they go through those really difficult years, that they can make it through and they can still feel that self-confidence that naturally takes a hit when girls are, you know, they're starting to change and they go through puberty and they just have different pressures on them than boys do. So we, through the GRIT initiative, have just put a huge amount of time and effort into intentional invitation. So GRIT looks different across all of our leagues, but, you know, just for some examples, you'll see girls only rides. At a lot of our races, we have all these great gatherings. So there is a tent and there's activities, whether it's arts and crafts or girls getting together to make cheer signs. Or a lot of our leagues will do a GRIT only ride. So the day before pre-ride, they will open the course only to girls for an hour. So all the female coaches and girls can get on the course together. And again, it's not all the time, but it really is creating an intentional invitation, an intentional space where girls can just be together. Because again, it's hard to be just one of the boys when there are so many boys. And we know that too. So again, with the Grit Initiative, we noticed that, and we know that girls need something a little bit different to not only feel willing to join a sport, but to stay in a sport, and then what keeps them there. So we're not even remotely done. We have a lot of work to do, but we're pretty proud to say that it's something that we spend a lot of time on intentionally within the organization, because we know the group of folks or the general demographic that we're pulling from isn't very, I will say, female ever in general too, right? The majority of mountain bikers especially are still, you know, vastly male. And I think Nike is doing a good job to put some intention and a lot of programming behind changing that.
It sounds like this has the potential to, like, a team or a league has the potential to just grow indefinitely. But how does Nike kind of prevent its failure from its own success, in the sense that, like, if a team kind of hits capacity, like if, or, you know, there's too many students for how many coaches you have, like how does Nike handle that?
Yeah, it's a good problem to have, I will say. I wish, believe it or not, I wish we had more of it, because what we see, at least across the United States, right? And it's my job to look at things big picture. But what I see in some communities, it's a huge issue. Others, it's not an issue at all. But I will say, in the community we do have, using Utah as an example, where even some of the school-based teams are already at 250 kids. And they are maxed out, right? And say we have no such thing as a tryout, but we do have limits, right? Where we absolutely can't have more than, in some of these teams, 250, 275 kids on one team, because there's just no space. There's nowhere to put them. So that absolutely is a limiter. And we do have some strategies internally. Absolutely. We first, in all of our coach education, especially when new teams are starting, it's funny, coaches, unless we teach them better, we really try to keep them focused on recruit coaches first. Trust us, the kids will come, because the kids are typically the easy part. But if you don't have enough coaches, then you will never have enough to, you know, to not only meet your ratios, but to give the kids a great experience. So even in our recruiting efforts, we encourage coaches and teams to be constantly recruiting new coaches in the same way that they're recruiting new student athletes. So it's definitely something that we have to stay on top of, because that attrition rate is constant, and we're never going to stop that. And really having enough coaches is key to success. And we also have some other strategies too, where we see a team is either getting too big. And I say we, is just everybody kind of keeps an eye on this, and the teams do as well. If we know there's a team, say, that blew up from 30 kids to 70 kids in 1 year, then we start preparing them for what we call splitting, right? The composite team split, where you take that team and you split it into two different teams so that you can not only minimize the impact, but you can increase the efficiency of managing that team. And that happens all the time. Just as an example, here locally in Teton Valley, when we first started our team, and I'll give you a growth example, because this happens often, was when my husband and I started the team. I think we started our first year with we had 7 kids and 11 coaches, which was pretty funny, because we were definitely overcoached, but I think we did it right. Because I think what happened is we gave the kids a great experience. They had a great time. The next year we were 40, right? And then the next year after that, we were 75. And then the next year after that, we were 100 and almost 20. And then that's when we knew it was time to split the team into two. So then we created a Teton Valley composite, and then we created a Jackson Hole composite, which were two different teams, right? And so I think that we every step of the way try and prepare for growth rather than limit it, because again, is that we started this whole thing, more kids on bikes is better. But we certainly do have instances where we are bursting at the seams, and then it just becomes really that management of that scale and size.
That's great. I think there's a lesson there for trail organizations as well, where sometimes we can get a little bit too big and that it just becomes more cumbersome, and, you know, not necessarily splitting the organization, but, you know, dividing and conquering, maybe you've got different riding areas, that kind of thing. So that seems like a great way to kind of handle that growth, which is great. How can somebody get in touch, find out more, and get a hold of their kind of local Nike league or local Nike team?
You could start with me. Easy. Amanda at nationalmtb.org. And I'm not kidding. I love it when people reach out to me individually. We also have a great website. Again, the national website is structured to point you in any direction that you need to for your local, whether it's a team or it's your local league. So nationalmtb.org. And you can find all of our leagues there. And in your local communities, again, starting from that website, starting from the league director, that it's just an ask. I think it's a basic introduction. I've seen this be really successful over the years. Of say, you know, you're the executive director of a local trails organization. You don't even know where to start. Like, you don't even know if you have a NICA league. Just start with a NICA website. Look to see if you have a league, and your first best call is just to that league director. That league director will be on the website, and they are going to know every single team, every single community. They're going to know what those local teams have on their plate, who the head coach is, and then they can put you in touch with that local head coach. There's a ton of information there, but really at the end of the day, our league directors in each state are amazing resources to put you in touch with your local community. And then the secret, which shouldn't actually be a secret, is just ask. I will tell, you know, your listeners that the average head coach, because I was one of them for a long time, we are very, very busy, like everybody in life. Like, we're working jobs, and this is a volunteer job, and sometimes we're just lucky to make it from the office to the trailhead ahead of the kids. That outreach and just saying, hey, this is who I am. These are some opportunities. Could I help organize a trail day? Or could I help? It's just, it's that offer of help that I think is really helpful to our volunteers, because again, all of our coaches are volunteers. They really want to give the best experiences to the kids, but most of them, don't know anything about trail work. A lot of them really don't. They are the leaders of their organizations, but they might not know who the local trail organizations are. And they're going to be your best person to outreach to parents, to outreach to kids, and get the group, you know, at least starting with awareness of what your local advocacy organization is doing.
Awesome. Well, Amanda, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you for the time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been fun.
This episode of the podcast was recorded on the traditional territory of the Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, Musqueam, and the Stolo. My guests join me from the traditional territory of the Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla, the new Segovia, and Shoshone-Bannock. If you're curious to learn more about the traditional territory that you occupy and recreate on, then visit native-lands.ca. Like always, you can find the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FrontlinesMTB. You can also join the Facebook group at Advocates on the Frontlines of MTB, and you can send me an email or audio file to info@frontlinesmtb.com. You can stream the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and if you haven't done so already, leave a review on wherever you get the show. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you to Yvonne, Jake, and Jeff for contributing to the conversation as Frontlines VIPers. Thank you to Drew, Jacob, Jeff, and Bev for your recent donations via PayPal. To become a Frontlines VIP member, to receive early info about upcoming shows, you just need to support the show via PayPal. You can find a link in the show notes. And in the show notes, you can also find links to the National Interscholastic Cycling Association. Big thanks to my guest, Amanda Carey, and Cynthia Kastner for helping to schedule and facilitate the conversation. Music, as always, is by Lee Rosevere. Production notes by Jennifer Pride. Artwork is created by Brandon Gallagher-Watson and BGW Creative. And finally, I'm Brent Hillier. This is Frontlines. Thanks for listening, and happy trails.